Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Velocity of Content. It's Friday, September 17th, 2021. Today, as we do each week, we check in with Publishers Weekly on news from the world of books and publishing. Now, sure, I know it's not Friday yet. It's still Thursday, September 16th, and you've dropped in just as we are about to record the show for release tomorrow. Welcome, then, to LinkedIn Live. Andrew Albanese, PW senior writer, joins me with his reporting and editorial analysis, as he does every week. Good to see you, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris. Good to see you as well.
Well, we are very happy to have you. CCC and PW are both delighted to welcome the audience here on LinkedIn Live for a special edition of our weekly conversation together. We're marking today the 10th anniversary in this series. We will have the week's news as usual in a little bit, but first we want to take a look back on a decade of publishing, technology, copyright, and more. Andrew, I remember where this all started. It started with Google, which is funny because almost everything now starts online with a Google search. But in our case, you were reporting for PW more than 10 years ago on a courtroom battle between publishers and the online search giant, a lawsuit that came to be known as the Google Books case.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that our first regular podcast together was 10 years ago this week, September of 2011. I just want to say that it's been a fun ride to be your regular guest every Friday on your excellent podcast. And I want to thank you for giving PW and me a space outside of our pages to talk about the publishing news and to offer my take and my analysis. And I want to thank the Copyright Clearance Center as well. Copyright Clearance Center has been a wonderful and supportive partner. And I also want to thank our listeners each week and say how much I appreciate the emails and the comments and the polite discussion that often follows our Friday shows. We certainly would not be here 10 years later if not for the listeners. So thank you for your support.
Well, I'll just add my own thanks to everyone as well. And to say it's fun doing this program. I learn a lot. It's always a great time to be with you, Andrew. And when we look back on when things started, we began our regular podcast together on Fridays in 2011. But our relationship goes back a little bit deeper than that. It all started when after you wrote a feature in that controversial case in 2009, I reached out to you and invited you on the show.
Yeah, so it literally all started with Google, as you say, so many things do these days. It was May of 2009, and I had written a feature on the Google settlement that, you know, didn't exactly win me a lot of friends among some publishing executives. Basically, it was a heavily reported piece, and I wrote that the Google settlement was going to die. I wrote about the powerful opposition that was lining up from the U.S. Department of Justice. There was Harvard librarian Bob Darnton, and there was authors and authors' estates, most famously the Steinbeck estate. And we'll talk a little bit more about this later. But, you know, yeah, Chris, you read the article and reached out, and we recorded our first podcast together. And what stands out for me most about that moment in time was, you know, the controversy, the anger that that piece generated among some of the settlement's architects, though it got a very favorable reaction from many other people. But I can still vividly recall a very tense, almost two-hour meeting in a PW boardroom with one major CEO, one of the architects of the deal, who really did not quibble with any of my reporting or analysis in that piece, but basically said that it was our job at PW to support things like the Google settlement. And I still remember my boss at the time, who was Brian Kenny, just calmly explaining that really that wasn't our role, that our job was to serve the publishing industry, which means holding sometimes publishing leaders accountable for their decisions which can affect everyone in the book business, and to give voice to everyone across the book business, which I think we did in that piece. And, you know, that especially applied to, you know, momentous decisions, policy decisions, like the massive Google settlement at the time. And Chris, I want to thank you because you didn't shy away from the controversy around that piece. You invited me on the show and you let me have my say. And of course, the rest is history because the settlement did go up in flames, or should I say down the drain more accurately. And I say that because one thing that also ramped up the tension over that piece was, well, it was a cover story and the cover illustration was of an image of a swirling drain and the word gurgle. But, you know, to this day, I remain committed to writing about the issues and asking tough questions that need to be asked. And I'm grateful that we have the chance to talk about the issues each week on this show.
Well, you know, looking back and thinking about that case, and it was the top story for so long, and yet it seemed so far away. Things have changed so much, not just in the publishing space, but in the technology space. And, you know, you and I talk together every week. That's what the listeners hear. But there's always a third partner there, and that's Jeremy Brisky, our co-producer. And I want to bring him on to the program as well. Jeremy Brisky, welcome. Welcome to LinkedIn Live and to another appearance, not your first, but to another appearance on our Velocity of Content podcast series. Good to see you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's good to see you, Chris. Good to see you, Andrew. And it's good to be on this side of the microphone.
Well, indeed. It's going to be fun because we're going to look at a decade of history. And one of those items is about podcasting and the way that podcasting has changed. Jeremy, you and I began working on the CCC podcast in 2006. And at that point, I had to explain to people what podcasting was. It was a new word. It was the word of the year in 2005, a portmanteau, as we say, of iPod and broadcasting to be podcasting. And it was at that moment, really podcasting 1.0. A lot has changed since.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I actually have some numbers on podcasting, and I'll actually look at those from 10 years back. So when we started the show here with Andrew, and 10 years ago, only 23% of the U.S. population had ever listened to a podcast, like once ever in their lives. And just 10% of the U.S. population reported that they listened to a show on a monthly basis. And fast forward to today, more than double that, 55% of Americans say they have listened to a podcast at least once. And more than triple that, 40% or 120 million people listen to a podcast at least once a month. But the real growth actually is on the production side. So 10 years ago, there were 50,000 podcast shows listed in the major podcast apps, or you might remember this, Chris. We used to call them podcatchers back in the day before there were actually apps. And, you know, I mean, 50,000 podcast shows actually is really impressive. I mean, that's quite a number. But today there are actually more than 2 million separate podcast shows listed. So a 40 times growth in that 10-year period. And I don't know exactly how many of those shows were started during the COVID-19 pandemic, but I guess it was quite a few because, you know, during the late spring and summer of 2020, there was not only a shortage of toilet paper, but also USB microphones. It was really tough to get your hands on a mic for a while. And Chris and Andrew, you might both remember too that, you know, as we were recording our shows during that time, the software that we use was constantly crashing because the traffic was just so crazy going to these sites because everyone was just at home and, you know, starting a podcast in the pandemic's early days. And what that means for us, of course, is that that's more competition for ears, but, you know, we've held our own pretty well. You know, when we started this podcast for CCC, we were releasing one episode every 2 weeks, and then we went to weekly, and then 10 years ago, twice per week when we teamed up with Andrew and PW for the Friday show. And in that time, we've had around 2 million total downloads, so quite impressive.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a content beast. We have to feed it twice a week, but, you know, there's never any shortage of stories. And Andrew, when we look back on the last 10 years, I think one thing stands out, that publishing is as much about legal battles as it is about battles over top spots on best-selling lists. And you've covered a lot of those. Tell us about this litigious decade for publishing.
Yeah, for sure. I have spent a lot of time in courtrooms over the last, you know, couple of decades, and I've had a lot of terrific lawyers and smart people guide me and guide our readers and listeners through some pretty complex stuff. And I think it's fair to say that most of the litigation that we've seen and talked about over the last decade since we've been doing this podcast has involved the digital transition, which kind of makes these seminal courtroom dramas great vehicles for telling the story of publishing. And I guess the two cases that I'd point to, both of which I was in the courtroom for, are, of course, Google, which is a bedrock case about book scanning, and the Apple eBooks case, the eBooks case, which was an antitrust case from 2012.
Right. Well, so let's start with Google. I mean, Google. And remind us, what was at stake there?
Yeah, so the Google case, you know, this is the case that started us on this podcast. And, you know, I'll avoid rehashing it all here because it was a long case with many twists and turns. But all these years later, I do have some general thoughts. on what it was like to cover that case and what that case means. And, you know, our listeners will recall Google started its program to scan and index tens of millions of books from library shelves in 2004. And the legal case against them was filed shortly thereafter by the Authors Guild in 2005, and was then joined by a group of publishers organized by the Association of American Publishers shortly thereafter. Now, remember, this was a different time in the history of the internet, right? The internet in 2005. And I think publishers at the time were, and authors were, rightly concerned about what Google was doing. But this ultimately wound up in court, I think, because of, you know, of a failure to communicate, for lack of a better term. Because, you know, for Google, they came to the table with the hubris of a tech giant, right? You know, gee, all you quaint little old media relics, can't you see that just trusting us to take all your stuff is good for you? And then on the publisher side, there was this idea that every single new use had to be permissioned and paid for, even if, and this was the case with a lot of books in the Google settlement, in the Google case, I should say, we don't know who to ask permission for or who to pay. So in the end, long story short, the courts found unanimously, pretty much every step of the way, that the Google case was, that the Google program, scanning program, was fair use and not copyright infringement. But the question I think we still have is, what did we really get from this battle? And if I'm being blunt, my take is that we kind of blew it. You know, with this litigation, I really truly believe to this day that we kind of blew a huge chance. You know, if Google and the publishers had been able to, you know, better come together. And by that, I mean, better than this failed settlement that was, as critics pointed out at the time, sort of like private copyright legislation. You know, I wonder where we would be today with the Google Books database. You know, it could be a lively, massive, and important resource for researchers and students, as well as for authors, and as well as for driving sales. But, you know, if I'm being honest, today the Google Books program is sort of languishing, right? The internet has moved on, and the massive benefit that Google once envisioned when it started scanning books has not materialized. And on the other side of the coin, the massive harm that publishers warned of didn't materialize either. Now, I'm not here to criticize anyone's position here because, again, this was 2005, right? The digital future at the time was unknown. There was real fear there and legitimate fear. But I do think Google, what Google had right was that this was an opportunity in that fleeting moment in time to take this huge opus of works, these old books, books with virtually no commercial value that weren't selling anything, and to save them from the dustbin of history by getting them online. The market was not going to do that. We need to be clear about that. Again, these old books were not selling. They were left moldering on library shelves. Many were orphaned with no identifiable copyright holders. They needed a bold effort to be saved. And of course, the coda to this case is now underway. You know, the publishers are back in court, this time with the Internet Archive, over the scanning and lending of old library books. Now, this case is fundamentally different because Google was about scanning books for an index, right? This was basically scanning books for machines to read. The Internet Archive suit is about scanning books for people to read. So I'm not going to wade into the weeds of that case here. You can follow my reporting on the PW website. But what I will say is that, you know, at the risk of being controversial again, to me, the idea that we're still litigating book scanning in 2021 is something of a failure, right? I think the book scanner is a machine. At this point in history, it should be a relic. Book scanners should be in museums with kids pointing to them and saying, like, what is that? You know, no one really wants to be scanning books in 2021. And the idea that we're still litigating book scanning in the age of Netflix is, in my personal opinion, it's just a little puzzling. And the question for me is really, is there not a better solution that we can reach in a boardroom? You know, maybe we do need to be in court for this. Maybe these are fundamental questions that we do need a court to weigh in on. But I still can't help but think that we're missing an opportunity here.
Well, if book scanning is still in the news, something that has been in the news throughout this period, but is getting hotter, is antitrust. And in 2012, you covered the Apple eBooks case. You actually ended up with a book about it based on your reporting, an eBook itself. And that was one of the few real substantive antitrust cases over the last decade. And of course, it ended with Apple and five major publishers being found liable for price fixing in the eBook market.
Yeah, in some ways, the Apple case was all born of the same fear of a digital world, because back when Amazon was bringing the Kindle to market in 2007, Google's out there scanning books and just freaking out publishers and authors, right? Amazon, on the other hand, had a different approach. They were in talks with publishers in boardrooms, and they were writing checks to publishers to get these books online when they were preparing the launch of the Kindle. And what always has leapt out to me about the eBooks case, the antitrust case against Apple, which was reflected in the court documents, is that the publishers were so concerned, and rightly so, about what Google was doing, about making sure that their copyrights were respected, that it appears that they never really bothered to ask Amazon how much they plan to charge for these new and improved eBooks on this new device called the Kindle. And then the Kindle launched in 2007, and publishers saw their $30 hardcovers being sold as eBooks for $9.99, and they hit the roof. For authors and publishers, they had problems on a few fronts. For one, the publishers believed that $9.99, which our listeners will recall a former New Yorker publisher Tina Brown famously called that pitiful, paltry sum, that that price devalued books. I mean, they had a point, right? Who would spend $30 on a hardcover from a bookstore when you could sit on your couch and download the same book for a third the price? And the other threat was that no competitor would ever be able to match Amazon's below market prices, right? Most booksellers don't sell lawn chairs and flashlights and stuff as well. They don't have the market capability that Amazon has. And the Kindle also now gave Amazon massive leverage over publishers, because not only did they own a huge chunk of print sales, they also owned over 90% of ebook sales. So along came Apple, which in 2009 was preparing to introduce its new iPad device. And sensing an opportunity, Apple approached the six major publishers at the time and worked with five of them to move the ebook market over to what is now called the agency model. Rather than sell ebooks like print books on a wholesale model, you know, more or less you buy for a dollar, you sell for two, to the agency model, which instead gave publishers the power to set consumer prices while paying a 30% commission to the resellers. And when that deal was struck, it fundamentally changed the publishing game. It changed the ebook market. You know, and I'll never forget, one of the things that stands out to me was the sort of oh crap moment when this case got rolling. Steve Jobs was asked by Wall Street Journal reporter Walter Mossberg why a consumer would pay Apple $14.99 for an ebook when Amazon had it for $9.99. And Jobs said, the prices will be the same. Well, how could Jobs have known that, right? And shortly thereafter, Apple and the publishers landed in the dock.
Right. And you know, we talk about Steve Jobs, we talk about the iPad, and I remember, and you probably were in the same room with me, the opening session of the old digital book world. And it happened to coincide coincidentally with Steve Jobs' announcement, unveiling, debuting the iPad.
That's right.
And that just seems also, as one of our viewers has said, just such a long time ago. Today, you go into a restaurant, they pass you an iPad like it was the napkins and the forks and knives. It's just part of our furniture, really. At that moment, though, it was very exciting and really did change the game. So looking back at that case with all you reported and all you've considered about it, what are your takeaways?
Yeah, again, I think, you know, publishing leaders at the time were facing the unknown, right? They were reacting from a place of real fear. It was a heady time, for sure. And you can't fault them for that, for sure. And in the end, even though they got sanctioned, their plan with Apple actually succeeded in giving publishers what they really wanted, which was control over their digital pricing. And, you know, I have to say this, too. When we hear price fixing and conspiracy charges, we tend to think about unscrupulous, cigar-chomping industrialists cutting these backroom deals. But that's really not the Apple case. And in her opinion, Judge Denise Coate even noted that Apple brought great innovation to the table and that the publishers approached this with good intentions and that none of what they actually ended up implementing was legal. It was just the way they got there ran afoul of the law. At the same time, you know, one of the things that has always landed sort of wrong with me was the idea that, you know, this scheme with Apple was something the publishers had to do to save the book industry. You know, the conventional wisdom at the time, and a lot of the media was writing about this, was that publishers were acting to save books from a marauding Amazon. But at the same time, these were not tweedy little publishers, right? These were billion-dollar conglomerates. And I think it is important to remember that the publishers each had negotiated and signed their terms of sale with Amazon, and they all cashed the checks. And, you know, I remember back in 2013, the New York Times is a good example. They wrote an editorial, and they concluded in that editorial that the Apple deal served to create a healthier book market for publishers and consumers. Well, healthier than what? You know, to this day, I think that opinion was based on some pretty breathtaking assumptions, to say the least, because for all of Amazon's warts, and let's be honest, there are quite a few, it was Amazon that took a flyer and invested in the creation of a consumer ebook business. And I hold that as a pretty major achievement. And on another front, and this is something we've talked for years about on this program, why is it that virtually all of the innovation in publishing comes from outside publishing, right? So, you know, unlike the Times, I can't so easily accept that it was healthy for a handful of billion-dollar conglomerates to band together to serve their interests, you know, even if those interests aligned with those of authors and publishers and readers, and even if they were banding together against this big, disruptive, monopolistic force like Amazon. You know, in his closing argument at the at Apple's trial, U.S. Attorney Mark Ryan, he said something that really resonated with me. He said, who knows how publishers would have eventually solved the 999 problem? And I've always found that to be a really important point to keep in mind. Meanwhile, we have another coda in this case as well, because the publishers are once again being sued for price fixing, and by the same class action firm that first filed suit against them in the Apple case back in 2011. But I'll say, you can follow this case on the PW site, but this suit alleges that they are now conspiring with Amazon to restrain price competition, which is a bizarre and very, very speculative claim. And, you know, personally, I'm doubtful that there's much, if any, there, but we'll see. You know, for me, the question is, you know, more about what happens now in the coming decade as we forge ahead in a new, more settled digital market. And a market in which virtually every other form of content is now available from some kind of streaming subscription service. So the last decade or two was really about establishing digital, and that was quite fraught. But the coming decade is going to have its challenges and its opportunities as well.
Okay, but there's an irony there, and there are plenty of ironies in the story you've just been telling us, Andrew, because as much as we live in the era of Netflix and Spotify, as you have talked about, the persistence and the resurgence of print has really been an important story this past decade and really in these past few years. So what are your thoughts on this notion that ink on dead trees is just not ever going to go away?
Absolutely good point. I think the resilience of print in the face of this digital transition is perhaps the most important takeaway of the last 10 years, because it really informs where we're going to go from here in the book business. You know, this week, Ian Bogost in The Atlantic wrote a piece about how much he hates ebooks and how great it is that print is, you know, hanging around. Now, I'm a fan of Ian's in this piece, but this piece was kind of simple and it wasn't exactly cutting edge, right? It was very entertaining, but we've been talking for years about print's resilience. So it was really no mystery that, you know, needed elucidation. But, you know, for immersive reading, let's just say this, people like print. We know this now. People like books. Not only old people like me, but young people like my kids. You know, you open a book and you start reading. There's no battery. You know, we like the tactile feel of a book. You know, if there's one thing we've learned, it's that, you know, people will read in many ways, but the book will always remain the preferred medium for immersive reading because the technology of print is just perfectly suited to immersive reading. And we like to have objects. We like to own these things. We like to see them and feel them and put them on our shelves and pass them around. They're great pieces of art in addition to technology for reading. So, you know, we have no similar attachment to ebooks, which exist as bits in the ether around us, right? So, you know, the question that all of this raises for me is that the last two decades were, and very much the last decade, were very much about publishers playing defense against the encroaching vagaries of digital, and understandably so. But now that we have a sense that print is much stronger, shall we say, than we initially thought, is it time to go on offense? Can we do that? Can we go on offense here? Can we take the thumb off the digital scale and come up with more tools and more powerful tools? And we can sell more print and more digital and all be a little bit braver about how we make books and reading available.
All right. Well, you know, there are so many top stories over the last 10 years to talk about. I'd like to get you to keep this to a fairly short list, but there are some that you do want to call out.
Yeah, I have a little bit of a list here, you know, because, you know, how do we really measure where the book business has come in 10 years, you know, from when I joined the podcast for the first time till now? And there's a couple of things I point out that we've talked about, major themes on our show. And one is that we're down to one major chain store, right? And we've talked a lot on the show about the trials and tribulations of Barnes & Noble over the years. And, you know, it's revolving CEO seat, shall we say. But there's good news now in that they have a new leader, James Don, from Waterstones. Things are actually starting to look up. My boss, Jim Milliot, reported earlier this month that sales at Barnes & Noble are up and that publishers are impressed and they're seeing a big improvement. But here's one thing I would point out. We won't really know because Barnes & Noble is now private, so no more public reporting. So we have one big chain store left, really, and we're not going to see their numbers anymore. Digital audio was a huge story. I've said this before, but 10 years ago, if you'd said audiobooks were going to lead publishers' digital businesses in 2021, no one would have believed it. But that's where we are right now. And it's been a huge boom to the book business. So we'll look for more of that growth in the coming years. Another story we've discussed a lot over the last decade is that it's really been a golden age for indie publishers, and not just the gold standard publishers like Sourcebooks, right? But small publishers, really small publishers. And these small indies are printing books, right? Technology has not only enabled them to produce print books more efficiently, but also to get them to market more efficiently. Social media has allowed them to market things more efficiently. And I'm going to point to the success of my good friend Giancarlo DiTrapano, who I watched firsthand start an acclaimed publishing house, Tyrant Books, from scratch in his Hell's Kitchen apartment and later in Italy. Sadly, Gian died while he was visiting New York from his home in Naples this past March. And that loss is still very raw for me. I'll never personally get over that loss because I love Gian. But I want to point out Gian because he was an inspiration and a good example of the power of books and the power of print and the power of people bringing bold, young literary voices forward. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that in the coming decades. So while Gian is gone, there are lots and lots of publishers out there just like him. And that comforts me a little over his loss. And of course, self-publishing. We've talked a lot about self-publishing over the years. It's now huge, and it's lost its stigma too. Though I must point out, it still remains sort of a mystery, a mostly, so shall we say, unquantifiable portion of the reading economy, but it's getting more authors noticed, and it's getting more people reading. So that's a big deal too for the industry going forward. And of course, the other side of that coin is consolidation, right? The big six of 10 years ago when we started this podcast is now the big four. Further, Penguin Random House has a piece of Sourcebooks, a big piece of Sourcebooks. Houghton Mifflin Harcourt is now part of HarperCollins, and Workman will soon be part of Hachette. So definitely worth paying attention to how this wave of consolidation all plays out in the coming years. As our listeners will know, I'm deeply involved in covering the library market, and the dysfunction in the library ebook market especially is a huge issue that has in the headlines quite a bit. And I think this has a pretty big impact on the reading economy and the health of our society, right? You know, it wasn't until 2015 that all the major publishers were on board with digital lending. And in recent years, some publishers have shown signs of, well, you know, withdrawing a bit. So in my personal opinion, the library ebook market is a little messy, a little needlessly complicated. And I really hope that publishers in the coming years with more data begin to better embrace how libraries support reading and sustain publishing rather than, as some clearly do, seeing publishing as a sort of lost sale. A huge issue too is the supply chain. You know, back when digital was supposed to be the future, the industry sort of, you know, allowed or actively scaled back on printing and production capacity. And now here we are in 2021, we've realized that, oh, hey, print is still king, right? Print is still the top. So how do we ramp that up again, especially in this age of COVID when the supply chain is being disrupted by fewer workers and shipping issues from overseas printing, et cetera? And of course, you know, a common theme on our show, we've talked about it today, is Amazon, right? I think Amazon remains a complex frenemy of the industry. And, you know, I think the new thing now is to hope that federal antitrust regulators will roll up their sleeves and get in there and change some things and ride to the rescue. We'll have to see how that all unfolds in the coming months and over the next decade. But definitely Amazon is going to continue to be something to watch.
Well, you mentioned COVID-19. Any reporting we've done in the last year and a half has brought that up so much. And what's happened with COVID-19 in the book publishing world is to accelerate, sometimes ignite some things that probably would have happened, but at a much slower rate. And there are more ebooks being loaned and read and bought, but also more print books. So talk about the role that COVID-19 has played in these dramatic changes.
Yeah, you know, for all the momentous things that we've talked about over the last decade, nothing has approached anything close to what the COVID-19 pandemic has meant, right? This is a generational, once-in-a-lifetime, hopefully less in the future story, right? The pandemic has changed almost everything. We've lost too many people, and we've endured too much tragedy. So first, I want to say sorry for everyone's loss who's been affected by this. And if you haven't yet, please get vaccinated, right? You know, wear your mask. Do what it takes to end this. It's time to be smart and to end this. But at the same time, the pandemic has shined a bright light on what was once considered normal. And it has actually set the stage in many ways for a new normal. we're seeing this in the way people are working from home and the way we're pursuing new workplace safety rules and this important, long overdue focus on self-care and on safety and on mental health. So, you know, I think these are very important things that I would hope that we would take advantage of when we start to rethink what we want our society and our industry to look like post-pandemic. Now, also for many years, we did this show once a year from Book Expo here in New York or from Frankfurt, the Frankfurt Book Fair or the London Book Fair. The future of book fairs is very much up in the air. But the good news is in the last 18 months, we've also harnessed the power of virtual to great effect. Now, I am going to be right open about this. You know, I sure hope we can find ourselves back at a book fair soon, you know, sitting at a table in Frankfurt, enjoying a good German beer in person. But I also hope that when we do get to do that, that we're also joined by thousands and thousands of more people online at the book fair through a virtual experience, because I worked in the publishing industry before I became a reporter. I never got to go to a book fair until I became a reporter. And I think that's sad. I think that everybody who works at a publishing house, no matter what department they work in, would benefit from being together at a book fair once in their lives at least. We've talked a lot about it over the last few years, but we've seen this huge reckoning via the Me Too movement, which has amplified the important discussion about abuse and equity in the workplace. That discussion needs to continue. The murder of George Floyd at the hands of police sparked a long overdue racial reckoning. And in the book business, which has long acknowledged its lack of diversity, but not really committed to seriously addressing it, I think we're starting to see positive signs on this front now. But we're going to know more about whether the talk equates to action in the coming months and years. But I'm very hopeful that we are starting to actually see real change there. And with all of this change, too, comes pushback, right? With the discussion of all of these things, we're seeing cries of cancel culture and platforming and, you know, free speech issues. And, you know, all I can really say to this is that, it's been a messy conversation, but it needs to be a messy conversation. And it's an important one. And look, we're not going to solve this all overnight. We're not going to get this right out of the box, at least not right away. But we have to go in the right direction. And I believe we are going in the right direction. Now, will we go too far in some cases? Sure. Will we go not far enough in some other cases? Yes. But there is a real and, I believe, honest discussion underway now. So we can't allow ourselves to get distracted by Dr. Seuss's getting canceled and fake outrage. We have to continue the work. And we have to recognize that the line towards progress, you know, doesn't go straight up. It's going to kind of go like this. But we need to head in the right direction.
Well, you know, you made a great point, Andrew, about book fairs. And I certainly do hope they return as well and as soon as they can. But with the hybrid environment that we've now created, as you point out, everybody can attend a book fair. That's an important thing. Everybody can attend the conferences. If you and I were having this conversation on stage in a hotel room in New York City, it would be limited to a certain group of people. Now everybody on LinkedIn can join us, and that's really exciting and really important. And that raises the whole point that I think we want to bring Jeremy Brisky back on to reflect on, which is the changes in technology that you and I have been a part of, Jeremy, over the last 10 years with Andrew and 15 years altogether. I mean, maybe we shouldn't tell anybody, but we started talking on telephone lines. We were recording the program on a telephone, on a conference call on the telephone.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's really interesting because for people who were recording podcasts 15 years ago and everyone was in the same room together, honestly, like not a whole lot has changed as far as how you recorded that show. But our challenge since the beginning was always that, you know, we wanted to connect with people across the country and, you know, and across the globe. So being in the same room was something that rarely, if ever, happened. And yeah, you're right. I mean, we started recording this podcast over landlines because that was the easiest way to get guests on, you know, with the technology that they were comfortable with. And then at some point we moved to Skype, which sounded better than a phone line, but certainly didn't sound great. And then eventually, you know, we moved to a platform that we currently use now, which is called Zencastr, which is a really great platform. And, you know, if guests are using a high quality microphone, it actually can sound like we're all in the same room, like in a professional recording studio together. And yeah, you know, I mentioned that microphone shortage earlier, which means that a lot of our guests now do have nice microphones. They're prepared to be podcast guests, which, you know, was never the case before. So, you know, we end up with a really really good sounding program. And then here we are actually on LinkedIn Live, which 10, 15 years ago, certainly we dreamed that we could have done this, but it wasn't something that, you know, was really available to us. So yeah, I mean, it's really come quite a ways in the last 10, 15 years.
You know, it really has it ever. I mean, the very first shows that we did, Jeremy, were repodcasts actually of programs recorded by Book TV. And in those days, yeah, you were in one room. There was a whole crew with gigantic cameras. And here we are on today, 15 years later, sitting in front of our laptops and presenting this program to essentially a global audience. Well, we have reminisced enough, Andrew Albany. So now it's time to get to the news, what we do every week. There are some important stories this week, and they're going to sound familiar.
Yeah, as if on cue, right? The news of this week involves, you know, strong sales for publishers in the first half of 2021. There's a new blockbuster on the way from Bob Woodward hitting shelves soon, so that's going to bump things up. And news about supply chain issues, and there's a new copyright infringement lawsuit this week. So I guess we should start with the good news, and that is that the industry had a really strong first half to 2021. My boss, Jim Milliot, reports, and it's on the Publishers Weekly website now, that by any measure, the first half of 2021 was a really good period for trade book publishing. Revenue at the companies that report to the AAP StatJob program were up 17.6 in the first 6 months of 2021. And remember, it's a huge year. 2020, excuse me, was a huge year by comparison. So being up over, you know, that much over 2020, it's kind of a big deal. You know, HarperCollins CEO Brian Murray attributed the healthy gains in fiscal 21 to higher consumer spending on books worldwide. And he said that he's never seen such sustained increase in book buying in his more than 25 years in publishing. So that's certainly saying something. And as I mentioned, we have new blockbusters on the way, including a new book, Peril, by Bob Woodward and Robert Costa, The Washington Post. So I look for strong sales that continues. And if we get a couple of big blockbusters in the last quarter of the year, these numbers could look really good. So despite the pandemic and the challenges that came with that, book sales in 2020 were up huge, and book sales in 2021 are continuing to cook as we enter the final quarter.
Well, we are entering that final quarter, Andrew, which means the holidays are coming. And if I watch Twitter from time to time, I see people involved in publishing of all sorts saying, place those orders now. People are really concerned about books being on shelves in December. And that raises the supply chain concern. And Jim Milliot has reported on that as well.
Yeah, so it's not really a frontline newsy story, but it's one of our top stories on the PW site now. And I urge you to check it out for sure. It covers a BISG webinar from the summer in which publishers and distributors talked about the challenges facing the market. And I think the news here is that the two biggest trade wholesalers, Ingram and Bookazine, have reached out to their accounts to urge them to take a range of actions to try to mitigate problems, informing them of steps that they should take now to be better positioned to meet the needs of the fall and the holiday, which are critical selling seasons. So it's a story that's worth reading and sharing because, as we just discussed, sales are booming for a second year in a row. But what might make or break the all-important final quarter of the year really is how well publishers manage their production and take into account things like printing capacity and paper shortages and shipping delays. So if you haven't already, by all means, check that out. I think it's a good barometer of where the publishing industry is right now, both in terms of the great sales and the potential, and also the potential challenges.
Well, let's close appropriately on copyright, because as you say, there is a new copyright infringement lawsuit in the courts. Pearson Education has gone to court against textbook service Chegg, and this is a story with a twist. Tell us what you think about it.
Really interesting case. So Chegg, of course, is a major textbook service, and Pearson, of course, is a major textbook publisher. And the backdrop of this story is, you guessed it, an uneasy digital transition, right? Pearson, like all education publishers, is really aggressively moving to digital. Anyone who's got a kid in school or, you know, in college knows that really digital is very central to education now. So what makes this case interesting to me is that specifically the suit revolves around a service known as Chegg Study. It's a subscription offering that, among its offerings, features answers to the end of chapter homework questions from various textbooks. And they charge $14.95 a month for this service, with the textbook questions that are being answered often copied nearly verbatim or with just slight changes, or so alleges the suit anyway. Now, Pearson lawyers told the court that the majority of Chegg's roughly $644 million, that's from 2020, it's a $644 million company, that the majority of that revenue comes from its sale of homework answers through Chegg Study. Chegg Study numbers, according to Pearson, about 6.6 million subscribers, at least it did as of 2020. Now, what Pearson is claiming is that, you know, repurposing these questions from their textbooks infringes their copyrights. Now, we haven't heard from Chegg yet, but I'd point out that Chegg is a for-profit company, right? Now, obviously, it would be hard for a court to foreclose the ability to answer a question to someone's homework on copyright grounds, but using the copyrighted questions from a textbook for a commercial service, yeah, I kind of can see the problem there. But what I really want to know, what struck me from the beginning here is, you know, where's everyone else? You know, in the court documents, Pearson notes that Chegg Study hosts millions of answers from some 9,000 textbooks. So I do kind of wonder, why Pearson out here alone on this? This seems like a quintessential case where a bunch of publishers might come together and bring suit together about this. But right now, it's just Pearson in this. Anyway, look for Chegg's response to come in due course and check back on PW for this sort of well-timed back-to-school story. And one final note, copyright question aside here, it's an interesting copyright case. Does it not seem to you that cheating on your homework is really sort of leveled up in the digital age?
It's unbelievable to me that it's become so acceptable. It's remarkable. But, you know, when it comes to answers, we're going to leave aside the textbook answers. We're going to go for answers about the book publishing business to Andrew Albanese. We'll do this next week. And if you've enjoyed our program today, let us know. Tell us what you thought of our show. Tell us if we should do this again. And please remember to subscribe to Velocity of Content Podcast, as well as to the Copyright Clearance Center blog by the same name. We hope you'll do that. You can find out all the information on copyright.com. But Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, thanks for joining me for 10 years on this podcast from CCC.
Chris, thanks to you. Thanks to Copyright Clearance Center. Thanks to all of our listeners. Thanks to Jeremy Brisky and Burst Marketing. Let's do it for another 10.
Absolutely. And listen, thank you, Jeremy Brisky. It's not just your producing roles, but you've kept us out of trouble so many times by cutting out all kinds of things and putting things back together. It's remarkable what you do every week. We really appreciate it. Thank you for maintaining a decade of high standards.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. Thanks, Chris.
I also want to thank Rob Simon of Burst Marketing, who's handled the board today for our special edition on LinkedIn Live. You can subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts, and please do follow us and CCC on Twitter and Facebook. As I say, be sure to sign up for CCC's blog series of the same name at copyright.com/blog. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening and watching. Join us again soon on Velocity of Content from CCC.